Hello. So this is the promised recording of the introductory lecture for EE321. Apologies again for the problems encountered on Monday. So I'm Jennifer McManus, and you can see my details there. If you would, I'm always happy to meet with students. If you would like to meet with me, usually the easiest way to get in touch is either to grab me at the end of the lecture or to send me email. And, if you have a question that can be dealt with over email, I'm happy to do that. Or if you would like to make an appointment to see me, that's perfectly fine as well. You can look for me in my office, but I am not in there all the time, so students usually find it easier to use some other method of finding me. So EE321 is Data Communications and Networks 2, and it is a continuation from Data Communications and Networks 1. So the idea with Data Communications and Networks 1 was that you would look at sort of the lower level of the network protocol hierarchy. So you looked at the physical, link, and network layers. And this gave you a good idea of how you could get bits physically from one end of the network to another. What we're going to do in this module is sort of reverse that project. We're going to start with applications, and we are going to see what are the various aspects of applications running over these data networks. And so our premise is that the network is offering some sort of basic delivery service to the applications, and we want to see how the applications interact and deal with that delivery service. Okay, so the primary reference is some version of Kuros and Ross, and there are a lot of these in the library, and so it's well worth checking one of them out. They do have a slight variations. The older versions use Java socket programming, so that's one section of a chapter. You can certainly find out about Java socket programming online as well. The more modern versions have a more thorough discussion of peer-to-peer networks and the idea of distributed hash tables to enable peer-to-peer networks, and we will be discussing that. Again, I think you can find information about that online as well. From our point of view, those are sort of the main differences. I think that the discussion of multimedia network applications varies slightly as well. Okay, so again, this course is going to start thinking about applications and sort of what are their requirements for what we're dealing with is distributed applications, so you know, one program interacting with another program running on another machine at a distance connected through the network. Okay, and again, our view is that the applications don't want to know the details of data transport, but they will be able to access fairly basic network services, which just say you give us your data and we'll transport it. And depending on what the application is, it's able to, the network services that are available to it are better or are more useful or perhaps slightly less useful. In particular, the basic network services essentially give you either reliable or unreliable delivery of data, and so you can control loss or not, but they say nothing about temporal aspects. So if you're streaming a video, delay becomes an important factor, and the basic services don't say much about that. So we'll look at quality of service and how applications, what are the requirements of applications, what are the quality of service aspects of the network, and then sort of how these two interact. We will, the farthest we'll dip into sort of the actual server, we will then look at the transport layer, which is, again, the layer responsible for providing these data delivery services, and we'll see how that, how it interfaces between the core network and the network layer and the application layer, and what are the how does it actually work. And so, first of all, next lecture, what we're going to look at is socket programming. So this this is how the sockets are the method by which the applications actually invoke the network services. Okay, the assignments that you're given are based on Java socket programming, and so. Java is nice because it abstracts away all the details of the operating systems. If you're using a language like C, then you have to be aware of the details of what operating system you're running on in order to properly implement the sockets. So Java, again, abstracts away all those details, and so you just need to some sort of fairly basic code to create the connections between our distributed applications. Okay, so in terms of the assignments, what you're going to have is four assignments, which sort of gradually build in functionality and complexity until you are sort of in the last one examining, again, quality of service aspects of your distributed programs. So, again, roughly that's one assignment a week, and I'm going to make them do at, since we only have 6 weeks, I make them do at the end of the six-week period, so that, if you're sick 1 week or something happens 1 week, then you're not stressing about having to turn the assignment in. But again, I would urge you to keep up this pace roughly of one assignment a week, and don't try and do them all in the last little window. Okay. So again, the bulk of the course is drawn from various versions of Kuros and Ross. The sixth edition is a pretty typical edition and would be fine for this module. The presentations, the PowerPoint slides, are also largely drawn from Kuros and Ross. They provide a very nice set of slides, so we will not reinvent the wheel, we'll just use their slides. Okay. So, this lecture should, by and large, be a review for all of you. Again, since you have seen the basics of networking and the basics of the network architecture in EE224. So, our goal for this lecture is, again, just to remind you of this setting for networks and sort of the basic premises, the basic design philosophy behind networks. Now, there's still a number of networks in the world, but we can... the internet is sort of the dominant paradigm. Okay, so we're going to take a little look about in this lecture what is the internet, and you know, again, we know that it's works because of a collection of protocols that allow. Again, the data that are designed to transport the data from one end to the other of the network. Okay. And so, again, in 224, you probably got a fairly flat view of what the network looked like, but another way of looking at it is... to think of, again, from an application point of view, the applications are on the edge of the network, and so at the edges, the main goal is just to connect into the network and to access the network services. And then once you are in the network, you have the network core, which is concerned with, again, the transport of data. Okay. And we'll see, our protocol architecture, our layered architecture, deals with both the edges and the core, but various aspects of the protocols are more important, either at the edge or the core. So the application layer and the transport layer are active at the core. The network layer is active, or sort of the transport and application are, you can think of as being the primary focus at the edge, and then the network layer is the primary focus in the core. Obviously, everything, you always need to have this physical connection, so at all, data link and physical layer are operating at all levels. So, again, at the edge you have your applications, they want the network service, but we'll see that the services don't account for these temporal the service will account for loss, but it won't account for temporal qualities like delay, and indeed throughput. And so what we'll see today is just how the design of the network has led to these loss, delay, and throughput being a component of the network. So you cannot design a network where loss, delay, and delay don't exist. And so we'll see where they enter into the picture, and later on we'll see how we deal with them. We won't be concerned with security in this module. And so we'll have a quick reminder of our layered model and a quick discussion of the history and where all of the, where all of this has arisen from. Okay, so what is the internet? Well, there's a physical view of the internet, which is just that it is a collection of equipment, devices, and again, at the edges, you have millions of devices which are trying to connect into the internet. So we refer to the end systems as hosts, and from our perspective, they need to be running these distributed applications or these network applications. So your host can be anything from your phone to the computer to a server. They're all connected into the internet using communication links, and again, you would have seen that there's quite a few different media over which you can communicate your data, and so these can be physical links or wired links or wireless links. Each link individually has some maximum transmission rate, which we refer to as the bandwidth. Okay, so there is, for any given link, there's only so much data. There's only a certain rate at which you can send your data. Okay. So, then, when you sort of move in from the edges of the network, again, we have this problem that we can't connect each device up one to the next. There's a scale issue, there's a resource issue, but so we need some way of forwarding the data from one device attempting to communicate to another device, and we achieve that using packet switches. Okay, and so the idea of a packet switch is just that it's going to forward data from one switch to the next, hopefully, you know, eventually the data will arrive at its intended destination. Okay. And so a number of devices can be used to to do this data forwarding. We have routers and switches, where a router we would think of as mainly dealing at the link layer. So if you have a shared medium, you need to, even within a single connection, you need to decide where your data is going, and switches then operating at the network layer, so being able to choose paths to transport the data from one switch to the next to the next. Okay. So the internet, then, is a network of networks. And so, again, the idea is that the equipment and the running of this equipment is not sort of controlled by a single entity worldwide, which should not surprise anyone, but rather you have regional entities, which then, again, will have to cooperate with each other in order to extend the range of the data transport. So the regional entities we refer to as internet service providers, and again, they will cover a certain region or territory up to possibly the a distribution across a country. Usually, the ISPs don't necessarily cross country borders. So again, you will have to have your ISPs interacting with each other in order to get data sort of across the globe. This interaction is achievable because the ISPs will all run an agreed set of protocols. Okay, and as long as everybody's running a protocol, the same protocol, then they should be able to interact with each other. So, just again, it's worth thinking about what exactly is a protocol. And what a protocol does is it sends and receives messages, and it sends and receives a fixed set of messages. And there is also an agreement as to what actions should be taken on receipt of the messages. Okay, so everybody knows what the messages are, and everybody knows how they're going to react to those messages. Again, that means that these protocols have to be available to all so that they know what these messages are and how they should react. And so we have standards repositories for these protocols. The internet standards are contained, are managed by the IETF, and they are contained in the RFCs, the requests for comments. Okay, so despite the sort of name request for comment, this is actually the repository for standards. So once a standard is fixed, it's no longer up for discussion. Okay. So, again, you would have seen, and particularly sort of within an ISP, how the protocols were used to transport packets through the system. So, again, if we step away and look from an application's point of view, an application really doesn't want to know the nuts and bolts, the details of how the packets are transiting through the system. They just want to know where they need to send the packet and essentially interact with their remote location. So, the infrastructure, we can see the ISPs as providing services to various applications, and those services might come in the form of applications themselves, so web browsers, email, games, etc. And so these applications, plus any other one that the end users may wish to create, need then to have some access to the network transportation. Okay. And so the network will provide services that allow a connection to the network, to the internet, and data transport through that connection. Okay. And what we'll see later is that there's just a few basic flavors to this data transport. And again, the socket will provide the interface that we need. Okay, so as we said, a protocol is a set of messages that can be sent and received, and an agreement on what actions will be taken upon the receipt of a certain message. Okay. So protocols can define the format of these messages, the order of the messages, and the actions taken on receipt of a message. Okay. And so, humans have protocols, although these are fairly loose and fluid, but you can ask what the time is and expect whoever you've asked to give you the time, or to say, "I'm sorry, I don't have a watch." You can ask a question, you can say hello and expect them to say hello back. Network protocols use programs running on machines, and everything done within the internet is governed by these protocols. Okay, again, you've seen examples of these for the lower layers of the network, and we'll continue with looking at the application and transport layer and what protocols work there. Okay, so again, from a human point of view, you can have an interaction by through a language. And so you would have some restrictions. Typically, people like to be speaking the same language, but human brains are a lot smarter than computers in general, and so, you can have a lot more leeway in exactly how you express your requests. But you can see we have here, you make introductions, and that establishes a connection, and then you can ask questions, expect answers, etc. The links made within the network tap in a similar fashion. If we look at actually establishing a connection between end users, which is what TCP does, well, the first thing they do is they send a series of messages to establish that connection. And so that's like the introductions. And then they can make their requests based on over this connection. And again, there would be a limited range of requests that could be made, and the responses, and with expected responses. Okay. So, again, if we can look a little bit more detail about the edge and the core of the network. And again, the edge is what we'll be focusing on in this this module. So, the edge is the is where end users will gain access into the network. And again, what they're doing is running distributed applications. And for the moment, anyway, we can think of this as what's called a client-server model. And so the easiest example of this is a web browser. If you want to browse the internet, then you're a client, and you use your browser to interact with some remote location that actually contains the web pages you want to view. And so the remote location with the web pages, the websites, is the server. And so the client, me, you, is requesting a service from the server. Please send me your web pages. And so we make some assumptions. We usually, in this sort of model, we assume that the servers are always available and that the client can access them at any time. Okay. So in order to have this access, obviously the client needs physically to connect into the network. And that can be achieved in a number of different ways, through a mobile access, through a home network with an ISP, through an institutional network. So all of these are just giving a different way of connecting into, again, the core network, which, and then the job of the core network is, again, just to move the data over a distance. Okay, so there are, again, a number of ways in which an end user can connect into the core network, but they will need to have some specific access point, okay, and typically they will, you know, in some way you will again be paying for that access, or some body will pay for that access. Okay, so we'll look at the various flavors next. Okay, and again, what you can think is that, again, in terms of performance, typically, in terms of bandwidth, it's the edges of the network, it's that first access link that is restricting your bandwidth, and that can occur, well, again, because of the physical limitations of the medium, and also because you might be sharing that medium with more users. Okay, so to look at examples, sort of one of the historically most common ways for a home to get access to a network would be over the telephone network. And so here the phone network would provide a modem which would allow the digital data to be transmitted over the telephone line. It would be transmitted to a central location and then forwarded onto an internet service provider, which would give you the access to the internet. Okay. And so telephone networks typically don't share channels, so you would get a sort of a dedicated bandwidth up to the point where you connected to the internet. And so, again, you can achieve reasonably good data rates, and you won't be necessarily sharing with anybody else. cable networks also provide internet access, and again, we see something somewhat similar to the phone network. We have a modem that allows the data onto your cable. The main difference between that and the telephone network is that now you have multiple users all attached to the same cable going into, again, the head office. And so your the cable will carry user data, and then again, usually your television, your channel active will be sending channel access as well. Okay. The main difference, again, is that now multiple users share the bandwidth that is to the cable head end, so to the main office. And so what bandwidth is available to any given user is going to depend on how many users are actually accessing the cable at any given time. Okay, so when we say user, obviously in this day and age, it's not just a single user making use of this modem, but typically you will have some sort of home network which allows multiple users or devices to connect to the same modem to achieve internet access. Okay. And so, again, this is achieved through some sort of network box, which allows for sharing of the access between multiple users, and the most typical, again, a home setting would be a Wi-Fi box. Okay, and so this will will regulate the access, and we can also add some intelligence, so we can add firewalls to sort of block undesirable content. And we can also use network address translation, which is slightly technical. It allows for multiple users to share a single IP address. Again, IP addresses are in this setting. Users do not, each of those devices will not have a permanent IP address, but rather when they try and access, they will be assigned a temporary IP address, and one IP address can, NAT box, a network address translation box, allows one IP address to be shared among multiple users. Okay, and so you can do that in any number of ways, but again, the idea is just to get access to, again, to the ISP. Okay, so that's typically what happens in a home setting. When you come to work, and think of DCU, then your network access is provided by the institution. So typically the institution is going to have mail and web servers. Those are going to allow you access to and access to the ISP. A lot of times that will be actually run through your a web proxy. Okay, these span a much greater area, and typically the network, again connecting users, will have many more individuals, and it will be a much more complex entity. But again, you can think of that as, again, leading out to a fixed access point, which then leads you on to the internet. Again, because there are many more users, they have to be significantly higher speed data rates connections. Another option is wireless access. Okay, and again, typically you will have a wireless link which will connect you to an access point which connects you to the ISP. Okay, and the two basic flavors of this are wireless LAN, so Wi-Fi. B and G is a bit out of date now, so N and AC, and they can give you extremely high data rates. And so those are found, again, in the home setting and also in Wi-Fi hotspots in Starbucks or whatever. The other large form of wireless access is the cellular telephone network. And again, the idea here is that you have a wireless link to an access point and out to the internet. And again, at least theoretically, we can achieve very high speeds. Okay. Okay, so the host, again, either the client or the server, will be interested in sending data across the network, and that data can either be a short message or a stream of data. In either case, the data will be packaged up into chunks, which we'll refer to as packets, to be transmitted. Okay, and just notationally, we will refer to the length of the packet as L. Okay, and so the first temporal quantity that we look at is that it will take some time to transmit that packet. So we'll have, again, notationally, a transmission rate, R. So that's the speed at which bits can be formed and put onto the medium. Okay, and if you have L bits that can be transmitted at a rate of bits per second, then the time it takes to transmit the entire packet is going to be L over R. And so this is going to be our first piece of, our first component of delay will be that we just physically have to transmit R packet, and that takes L over R seconds. Okay, and as we said before, that can happen over a number of different media. And so these can roughly break down into wired media and wireless media. And sometimes we'll think of that as being guided media or unguided media. So with the guided media, it has to, the transmission follows the physical medium. And for unguided media, like radio, it just propagates freely. Okay, so you've, in terms of guided media, you have everything from twisted pairs, so two wires. Why am I not in slideshow? There we go. To a coax cable, which has better transmission properties, to fiber optics, which again have higher speeds and lower error rates. Okay, so radio, there's no physical medium, it's just propagates through space, through the environment. And so there's a couple of drawbacks to that. Obviously, if multiple entities are transmitting at the same time, then those signals are all just going into the one medium, so there's got to be some way of sharing the medium. And also the environment is going to affect propagation. So if you don't have, if you're not out in the middle of space, then you have objects and you're bouncing off those objects, you're bending around those objects, and so that will affect the quality of the signal. Okay, and again, there's a wide variety of different radio links. For the internet, the main ones, they're mainly used as access points. The main ones would be local area networks, so Wi-Fi, or cellular networks. And there would be some amount of satellite communication as well. Okay, so that's how you access. So that's the network edge. So we can think of that as essentially a single link that is getting you connected to an ISP, which will then connect you further into the internet. So once again, the end user has achieved a connection, again, it basically, they don't want to be concerned with how the data is transported, but obviously there is a whole, there's a whole lot of equipment, infrastructure that allows the data to be moved over long distances. So the core we can think of as being a mesh of interconnected routers. So no single entity, again, is going to have control over worldwide transport. So you move through from one domain to the next to the next. The packets that we created are then switched through the network, and this means that, again, we address the packet to the sort of end destination, and then each router along the way, or each switch along the way, decides where to forward the packet in order to ultimately get it to its destination. This is done because of this method. It uses what's called store and forward, so each packet is arrives at the switch. It is fully received, examined, and then retransmitted. We'll see later is that's going to introduce delay at each node. And again, in 224, you would have seen the methods by which the forwarding aspect of the packets are achieved. So how the nodes determine if not the optimal path, then a desirable path for the packet to take is. Okay. The transmission uses what's called statistical multiplexing. So if there's more packets than the switch can deal with, then they will queue up, and each packet is transmitted at the full link capacity when it reaches the front of the queue. So, again, the store and forward is meaning, at the very least, at each intervening switch, you are having to retransmit the packet. Okay. And so we already said at the edge, our end user forms up a packet and transmits it out, and that takes L over R seconds to fully transmit the packet. If we have one intervening node or switch, then again it's going to be received and fully having to be retransmitted at that switch. So that means that you have another factor of L over R. Okay, and so the more nodes that a packet has to transit through, the more time this is going to take. And each time you have that packet transmission time. Okay. So, additionally, as I mentioned, we're using what's called statistical multiplexing, which means that we allow, if packets need to be switched, if they arrive at a certain switch, and then the switch serves them as fast as it can, but you may have more arrivals than you can serve at any given time. And so that will mean that in addition to having this additional transmission time, you're going to have some time waiting just to be transmitted, okay? And you can think of that as being some additional number of packet transmission times. It's very hard to predict how many there's going to be. So so you get a random amount of delay introduced into your packet transmission, or your packet delivery. Okay. Additional to this, if too many packets arrive, then there's only a finite storage space. You can't store an infinite number. So in addition to being delayed, if there are too many packets, then some of them have to be dropped. So you're introducing not just delay into the system, but potentially loss. Okay. So again, it's the routing is key function of these switches in the core of the network. They decide how to, along what link to forward the packet. And they do this according to some table, which is produced according to a routing algorithm. And again, last year you saw how to produce a good routing algorithm. Based on those table values, again, they forward the packet to the appropriate link. Sorry, to the appropriate next node or switch. Okay. And so again, that's one way in which the core of the network is developed, and it's the one we are used to thinking about. Now, in practice, in portions of the core, we will use circuit switching. And in this case, we reserve end-to-end resources for calls for a connection between source and destination. Okay. And again, you would have there's a lot of reasons why, from an individual application point of view, circuit switching is not a good paradigm, but actually within the core of the network where we can aggregate data, sometimes it is more appropriate. But just again, to keep in the back of your mind what it is, you've reserved your resources end-to-end, and so that is great for the two people, the connection itself. So you've sort of minimized any performance hits for your connection because your resources are just there and waiting for you. From the network point of view, it's not so good if you're not always using that connection. Okay. And so this was traditionally used for the telephone network, where what you were trying to do was transmit a voice conversation, and the amount of bandwidth required for a voice conversation was fixed. And you would, when you're talking, you are constantly using that bandwidth, so it was an efficient way of allocating resources. When we started trying to run these distributed programs, frequently the data was just small messages which were being sent sporadically, and therefore it wasn't as efficient a use of it wasn't a very efficient use of network resources. Resources were reserved but idle a reasonable amount of the time. Now, again, that is true end-to-end. Where circuit switching tends to be used is, again, in the core, where data can be aggregated, and therefore you can have more assurances that you're actually going to keep any reserved resources busy. Okay, so with circuit switching, you can divide your link into a number of sub-channels, sub-links, and you can share out those sub-links between a number of users. And again, you can do this by giving them a different frequency allocation, as long as their signal fits within the bandwidth then of the sub-channel. Or you can do this by giving them individual time slices. And again, there's the place where circuit switching is not as useful is when your data is bursty. And so here we have an example. We have a megabit per second link that we want to share among N users, and each user uses 100 kilobits per second when they're active, when they're transmitting, but they only transmit 10% of the time. And so if we use circuit switching, we would have to make a connection, reserve the resources, and you would have 10 users maximum. And once you had reached that, you know, once you had had the 10 users, then you wouldn't be able to accommodate anymore. Any other attempts at connecting would be blocked. What you can work out is, again, if you have statistical, with packet switching, with statistical multiplexing, then it's, you know, a matter of queuing. And you can even ask, sorry, what's the likelihood of having to queue? So that's the probability you have more than 10 users active, linked anyway, to the probability of more than 10 users active at any time. And that is less than 0.0004. Okay, so it's unlikely that you will have significant queuing. Now, having said that, the more users, this is all variable. This is you would have a statistical distribution on this. And so you would actually have queuing. The more users you have, the more likelihood you have of having to wait. Okay. So packet switching is good for bursty traffic, but it does lead to delays due to the queuing. And so there's some typically, again, what the way that this is dealt with is just to try and throw resources at it, so try and transmit faster and more data at any given time. There is some interest in providing sort of building circuit-like behavior, so reserved resource-like behavior on top of a packet-switched paradigm, and so we will have a look at what people's thoughts on that are later in the module. Okay, why do we care? Well, again, the reason we care is that more and more applications are delay sensitive. So all of your streaming video, voice and video applications are sensitive to delay, and they're becoming more common. And so we have to have some way of dealing with, if we just have our basic circuit switch network, we have to have some way of dealing with the delays introduced. We can either, what we'll see is we can handle that through the applications, or we could suggest that the network should be changed. Okay. So, again, we've said that this core network is owned by multiple entities, and these same entities frequently also provide the access for the end user. And so we can think of, working our way in. We've got access ISPs, Internet Service Providers, which will provide the access for the end users. And these, in turn, have to be connected up. And through regional and greater connections. Okay, so the ISPs again, have some fixed region of influence, some fixed area over which they're operating, and then they will have to interact with each other, you know, again, to forward data on. And so it's not only hierarchical in a physical sense, but there's also sort of regulatory and economic issues come into play. Each ISP is transporting data, is in the business of transporting data to make a profit, and so the extent of their cooperation is going to be driven by the bottom line. And also, each ISP is regulating in a certain national context, and so any sort of national regulatory issues will also influence the operation of the ISP. Okay, so if we have a look at that. Okay, so again, at the edges, we've got everybody needs some access into the network. So you get all of these access points. And obviously, we can't connect each one to the other. There's a scale issue and there's also a distance issue. You can't physically run a wire around the world and expect the signal to be useful. Okay. So, we can't do that. And so, we could think of having a small number of global ISPs, and so they will have to have some sort of contractual arrangement between customer and provider, and also some contractual agreements amongst themselves. But they will, but typically, again, that might make sense. That makes sense from a sort of purely technical point of view. But again, we're driven by the idea of trying to make a profit. And so typically, even within a given region, you're going to have a number of different entities providing this service. And so they need to be connected to each other. Okay. And so they can be connected by peer linking, so you can directly link in some cases switches together, or you can have internet exchange points, which will again make some sort of routing decision between the different ISPs. At the edges, you may also, again, just for the purpose of efficient access, end up developing regional access networks. Again, just to sort of aggregate the end user data together. Okay, so again, that leads to a somewhat complex picture where you have a lot of different entities trying to coordinate with each other. And again, the coordination is facilitated by all the internet protocols, but will also have to be governed by contractual relationships. And on top of that, you have you have media providers who, again, span these regions. So, for the purpose of providing content, again, we might think of having one server to which we connect. So you want to watch Netflix, and you might think of there's some Netflix server somewhere, and we're trying to connect to it. But in reality, the content providers also have distributed networks for storing and providing their content. These are, again, built on top of the networks of the ISPs. Okay. Okay, so we'll get to this sort of very hierarchical view of the network, where at the bottom end we have our access ISPs, which are just facilitating users, small numbers of users, gaining access. And at the top end we have the, what are called Tier 1 or commercial ISPs, whose main function is, again, bulk data transport. And working alongside and in conjunction with these, we have our content provider networks. Okay. Which, again, we'll see later, are trying to bring the content as close as possible to the users, again, for performance reasons. Okay, so again, the main thing is just that it's a slightly more complex picture than we might have originally had in our heads. And so, in general, we're not going to be too concerned with the details of that picture, but again, it will be used sort of to justify sort of certain decisions that are made about how things are implemented. Okay, so pulling away from that picture again, a lot of some of what we do in this module is going to be to look at the quality of service and how applications sort of deal with quality of service issues. So we're going to just lay down the basic framework for thinking about that quality of service, and namely, that the quantities that are of interest to the applications are delay, loss, and throughput. And right now we'll just see very abstractly where those factors come from. Okay. So we already said we've got store and forward network, and so packets are arriving to a link from multiple directions, and then if there's more arrivals than the switch can handle at any given time, then they have to queue or wait for their turn. Okay. So we see a number of delay factors. There's the amount of time it takes to transmit the packet, so to form all of the bits within the packet and put them on the link. And then if we're in a queue, we're waiting for a number, you know, a number of packets to be transmitted before we even get to that point. And if our buffer fills up, then arriving packets are dropped, so we have also introduced loss into the system. So we say that there are four factors related to delay. There's processing time. So we said the packet has to be examined to decide what to do with it. And so that's processing time. And we typically think of that as being quite short. And so we don't necessarily worry about it. There's the queuing delay. And so that's the time it waits. You wait until you can even be transmitted. And that's a function of the size of the queue and sort of the average packet length. And that one is sort of the hardest to deal with in the sense that it's unpredictable, it's variable, it depends on how much traffic is arriving, which again is hard to quantify. Then we have packet transmission delay, and so we've already said that that's the length of the packet divided by the transmission rate. And finally, physically, it just takes time for the signal to travel over the medium, either through space or over a wire, and that's our propagation delay. Okay, and that's on the order of 10 to the 8th meters per second. And so the delay is a function of how far you have to go and then the speed at which you can travel. So it's D over S. And so, again, if you're traveling around the world, that can add up. Okay. And again, you should have seen this, but the transmission time and the propagation time are different quantities, and you know, definitely make sure you have them sort of clear in your head. Okay, so here's an example. We have cars. We can think of each car as being a bit, and the cars collectively as being a packet. And so the cars move at a certain speed. They're going down the road. They move at a certain speed. So 100 kilometers per hour. The toll booth takes 12 seconds to service a car, so that's our bit transmission time. And so, again, there's going to be a time that takes to actually, for all of the cars, the caravan, to exit the toll booth. That's going to be your transmission time. And there's going to be a time it takes the cars to move physically, then, from one toll booth to the next, and that's the propagation time. So you can ask, how long is it going to take until the caravan is lined up before the second toll booth? Well, first, all of the cars are going to have to clear the toll booth, and then the very last car has to arrive at the next toll booth. So it takes 120 seconds for all of the cars to exit the toll booth. And then the last car needs to, all of the cars have arrived when the last car obviously gets there. And you're traveling 100 kilometers at 100 kilometers per hour, so it takes you an hour. So it'll take you an hour and 2 minutes altogether. Okay. So, if you play around with your propagation speeds and your transmission times, then sometimes people get themselves a little muddled. So we're now transmitting at a much greater rate. We're propagating at a much greater rate and transmitting fairly slowly. Okay. And what we see in this case is that you will still be transmitting the packet when the first bits of the packet arrive at the second toll booth. Okay. So, it now takes 6 minutes to propagate, so to move from one toll booth to the next. And so the first car takes a minute to be transmitted and 6 more minutes to arrive at the toll booth. And so 7 minutes altogether for the first bit to arrive. And at this time, you have only processed or only transmitted 7 of the 10 cars. Okay, so sometimes that idea can sort of seem a little odd. But just sit down and think about it for a bit, and it'll be fine. Again, the main thing is just to realize that, again, these two quantities, the transmission time and the propagation time, are separate quantities. And then think about how they impact on packet delays overall. Okay. So, one final note on delay, and that's the queuing delay. And again, this is a function of the fact that our behavior, it's not regular, it's not predictable. There's some sort of probabilistic distribution around the arrivals of the packet. And so if everything was arriving at regular interval, then again we would essentially march up to a certain rate at which we could process our packets, and then beyond that rate everything would be dropped if packets were arriving more frequently. But in actuality, we have a So if we take a look at our traffic, we can define what's called traffic intensity, and that's essentially just a measure of on average how much will the link be occupied by the traffic presented. So what we see is we have our L over R factor, so that's seconds per packet, and then we have the average packet arrival rate, packets per second, and so we'll get a unitless number, which is essentially a proportion. So if you can transmit 2 packets per second, say, and you have two arriving, then that would be, A would be 2, L over R would be 1/2, and you'd have an intensity of 1, and that would mean that if everything was going smoothly, you would fully occupy your link. Now, the problem is that things don't go smoothly, so the closer your traffic intensity gets to 1, given variable arrivals, the more likely you are to have a queue building up, and with a queue building up, you have queuing delays then. Okay, so if your traffic intensity is near 0, then everything's fine. You don't have much of a queuing delay. The closer you end up to this 1 factor, then your queuing delay is going to be shooting up and up and up. The reason for that is that you're going to see ever lengthening queues, not all the time, but in general. If your traffic intensity is greater than 1, then this indicates that you have more traffic than you can handle. Okay, so your queue will be unstable no matter what, no matter how efficiently you service it. So you have to assume that your intensity, at least the average, is going to be less than 1. But the closer it gets to 1, the worse things look. Go. Okay, so if your queue is infinite, again, you can experience greater and greater coming close to infinite delays. But in reality, you're just going to have a finite amount of space in your buffer. So when you arrive to a full queue, then your packets will be dropped or lost. Okay. What happens to lost packets depends on your transport layer, well, either your application or your transport layer protocol. They may or may not be retransmitted. Okay, so we've seen a little bit about how delay enters into the system, and a variable delay even through the network, through the queuing at nodes, and also loss. The final quantity that, again, our applications might be concerned with is throughput. And if they have a stream of data, then they will need to be able to achieve a certain rate, a certain transmission rate. Okay, and so we can think of this rate as being instantaneous. So we could plot it at any given time as it goes through a certain link. Or, more likely, we look at the average rate over longer periods of time. Okay, in particular, in packet switch systems, you can't guarantee that at any given point you're getting your bandwidth. But if we just think of it in terms of capacity, then we note that our data is usually transiting over multiple links, and the overall rate at which the overall throughput, the overall rate at which the data can transit through the system is limited by the smallest capacity link, so the slowest rate. Okay, and frequently people liken this to a pipe, so again, you can only, it's the delay or bottleneck is at the smallest capacity. Okay. So, if RS is less than RC, then the end-to-end throughput is going to be RS. If RS is greater than RC, the end-to-end throughput will be RC. Okay. So, it's always limited by the lowest rate. And I think, as I mentioned before, the lowest rate typically occurs at the edges. Okay, so getting the access to the internet. But again, it's of no consequence in the sense that the user will experience the bottleneck regardless of where it actually is. Okay, so we'll be returning to these delay, loss, and throughput factors in a number of areas in future topics, in particular when we're about looking at quality of service for applications. And so it's useful to understand where these quality of service elements arise from, okay, because that tells us either, that tells us potentially how we can deal with them. Okay, so we've been talking about our protocol layers, and we've been physical, data link, network, transport, application layer, and this is the layered architecture is the way in by and large in which the network is arranged, and so each of the protocols are going to in the stack. Just use the services provided by lower layer, by their lower layer counterparts. Okay. And so any complex system is going to be divided into subcomponents, and these subcomponents then will have to interact with each other, so we'll essentially use each other for various reasons. And so, just logically, as it arises, this stacked architecture, this layered architecture, works very well for networks. So, again, the basic concept is that if you have protocols, they will, and these are distributed, so they're sort of being run at entities which are physically distributed from each other, and functionally, each protocol wants to talk to its sort of corresponding number, its corresponding remote number. So ticketing talks to ticketing, baggage talks to baggage, or communicates with baggage, or has information for baggage, gates and gates, takeoff and runway, and routing. But in terms of achieving achieving the communication, you have to go through the steps in order from top to bottom and then from bottom to top. Okay. So if we have an airline example, well, the first thing you have to do is buy a ticket. Then you have to check your baggage. Once you've checked your baggage, gotten your boarding card, you can go to the gate. You're loaded. The plane takes off. And then physically now, through the routing, physically the plane moves over the distance. So carrying the information, all of the information with it. So you still have your ticket, you have your baggage claim check. Yeah, you know, the airline knows that you boarded, etc. And then at the other end, again, you have to go back up through the steps. So the airplane lands, it gets access to the runway. You offload at the gates. You go to baggage claim. Maybe back to ticketing if there's an issue. And so at baggage, you need your baggage ticket to collect your baggage. If you have a problem and wish to complain, you need your ticket to make that complaint. Okay. So, each layer then has a service. It relies on the services provided by the layer below. And again, in a distributed fashion, the services are linked from at the two ends. Okay, so this model works well for networks. Again, we can think of, again, at the very bottom, well, we need to form bits and we need to transmit bits. Then, so that's the physical layer. Then we need to make sense of the bits. We need to make sure that they're actually arrived correctly. That's the link layer. Then we need to get them over more than one link. That's the network layer. And we need to connect not just physical entities end-to-end, which is what the network layer does, but actual applications end-to-end. And so the transport layer will allow you to do that. And then the applications run on top of that. Okay. By splitting it up into these tasks and making it modular, then it is easier to change any given portion, any single task, and as long as you keep the services the same, you're not going to affect the rest of the rest of the tasks. Okay. So again, you know, the TCP/IP stack has these five layers, from the physical to the link layer to the network layer to the transport layer to the application. Or going down the other way, you have applications. The transport layer allows applications to establish a connection over the network between each other. The transport layer then relies on the network layer to send data over that connection. The network layer, of course, needs to send the data hop by hop, which is what the link layer does. And finally, the link layer relies on the actual physical transmission of bits. So that pretty much represents the protocol stack as it's implemented. The ISO reference model has a similar structure, but the application layer, so above the transport layer, It also adds the presentation and session layer. And so essentially, in terms of implementation, people have seen fit. They have not seen a real need for these, and for those applications that do need these sorts of function, this sort of functionality, it's just built into the application itself. Okay. So, again, what happens is, again, our data will be broken up into messages or sort of finite pieces. At the transport layer, a header is added, and that's the information that is needed by the transport layer at the destination to know where to send the data. And so this adding of the header is referred to as encapsulation, because we are now just assuming that anything that arrives from a higher layer is data. We are not concerned with the information contained in that data. So we don't need the meaning of the message. We just know that it's a sequence, that it's a collection of bits. So the transport layer sends that data then down to the network layer, which adds its own header information. Again, it views both the transport layer header and the message as a sequence of bits. That gets dropped down to the link layer, which also adds header information, so forms a frame, and then that is physically transported through the network. Now, at any given point, the data will go up and down through a number of layers, but until you reach the destination, not to the application or transport. So if you have a local area network connecting you to the ISP, connecting you to the access point, then yeah, you only go through the link layer to transmit to the access point. Later on, as you're going through the core of the network, well, again, you need to go up to the network layer to determine what path you're taking through the network. But again, you aren't going to the transporter application layer. And then finally, when you reach your destination, you move all the way up the stack. And so here we see, Okay, so again, we aren't going to really deal with security. And so we'll move on to say a few words about history. And particularly compared to the telephone network, the internet, so data networks, are quite new. So, over 50 years now, but the telephone network goes back over 100. Okay. And so, again, it started with just this, the original idea was that you would have a mainframe somewhere and you would have a number of terminals trying to access a mainframe. And so then once that idea was, once you got to that idea, then you thought, well, why couldn't the terminals actually communicate with themselves? If they were a bit more intelligence, then they could communicate between each other. Okay, so in 1961, the queuing theory analysis was performed to show that, again, packet switching would be more effective for the types of data traveling over these networks. The initial projects were for the military, and so they were interested in sort of reliability of the network in the face of failure. Okay, so the original architecture would have had the sort of, again, you would want multiple links between between any two points, and you would want them to be robust. You would want to sort of a distributed decision-making process that could survive the failure of any given node or link. Okay, so that's in the early 70s, we ended up with the sort of very basic of idea of the core of this network, and it would have a few applications, including the first email program, and it consisted of 15 nodes. Okay, so that was sort of a demonstration that it could work, and from there people saw the non-military possibilities, and over the 70s, people explored how to develop these networks to a larger scale. Okay. So, a number of entities worked to develop different protocols and architectures, so there was no sort of, there was not one unifying architecture, although, again, TCP/IP was becoming a default. Okay. And it was during this time, despite the proprietary architectures, it was also during this time that the sort of basic principles of internetworking were sort of developed. And these include sort of minimalism and autonomy. So you want to keep things as simple as possible and not have necessarily centralized points of failure. Part of the simplicity would be a best effort service model. Trying to provide guarantees would be more complex. Stateless routing, again, maintaining state would be complex, and not as scalable for users. And decentralized control, it allowed for, again, scaling of size. Okay. And, these principles characterize today's internet architecture. So, in the 80s, again, TCP/IP came to the fore, and some of the basic, the sort of classic internet protocols were developed. So these include the domain name service, so translating between domain names and IP addresses, FTP, TCP, sophisticated mail protocols, etc. Okay, so these are the sort of basic, elastic, non-real-time applications that, again, still exist today. Okay. And we see that the size of the network has increased to, you know, 100,000 nodes. So you're beginning to get sort of a large community of users. And we also, see the rise of the commercial interests. Yeah, you know, as the number, you know, as you actually have customers, you can actually look at it in a commercial sense. Okay, and so then things exploded over the 90s and 2000s. And again, it's had to do with the sort of growth of the user community. And then the advent of the World Wide Web. Okay, and so this is what made using the network attractive to a sort of large community. Okay, and so if you think about how exciting things must have been when, you know, again, the web did not exist, then you were limited to email and text-based fora. You can see that the web is really what's the sort of has dragged in. You know, the web is clearly what's dragged in all of the users, and you know, again, the content, the media content that the web enabled. Okay, and so we now have millions of hosts, tens of millions of hosts, hundreds of millions or more users, and running at, you know, extremely high data rates. So, it's fair to say at this point that, you know, again, the internet is everywhere, and it underpins communications, surpassing that of the old telephone network, and has become sort of ubiquitous. Okay. So, and that's just, pretty much just a framework for thinking about the networks. And again, we're going to be concentrating on the application end of things. So we'll look at access to network services via sockets. And then we'll look at sort of classes of applications and what's interesting about them. So that includes our classic applications, so non-time critical applications, and then our more time-sensitive applications. And we'll also take a look at the transport layer as the way in which our network services, our connectivity services, are enabled. So that's it, and so the next topic we'll have a look at is sockets, so that you can get started with your assignments.